Hi there, and welcome to the Feeling the Sonic podcast. My name is Stephen Connor, and I will be your host for the next hour or so. This is episode 14, and the title of this episode is Jamie from Undead Collective Records. Joining me as my guest from Undead Collective is singer, songwriter, engineer, entrepreneurial label owner, and all-round muso, Jamie Giudiputo. Hi, Jamie. How are you?
I'm good. I'm feeling the Sonic.
You're feeling the Sonic. I'm very glad. I think we should all be feeling the Sonic. I don't actually know what that means, actually, but I suppose it could... it's one of those things that you basically... it means whatever you'd like it to mean.
Exactly. And that's how I'm feeling. Brilliant.
I'm feeling the Sonic, yeah. I mean, I think probably... do you know what? I think I should basically... was it Ian Dowie, I think, the footballer that... coined the phrase bounce back ability.
Yeah, that's the one, yeah.
Which was a new entry into the, you know, Oxford and Cambridge English Dictionary. I think the Sonic should be in there.
Yeah, well, why not?
Yeah.
You've got a dream to achieve and believe. Come on.
Exactly. So, and that's exactly what I'm doing. I'm living this dream. I'm living this Sonic dream.
That's it,
and
yeah.
But it actually came because a few people have asked me, actually, while we're on the subject, about where it came from. And it was kind of... a combination of, you know, with the songwriting, I was trying to get something that related to, because obviously it started off with the first kind of part of the word I had was verse.
Yeah.
And I was toying with the idea about, you know, verse or, you know, vercore or getting a chorus in or a bridge or whatever it might be, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And then because of the, you know, quite a lot of people know about me that I was a bit of an Oasis fan back in the day.
Just a bit.
And to this day, of course.
Just a bit.
And I wanted something that was kind of supersonic or something. So I put, it was literally a merging of those two words, verse and supersonic, and kind of cut the middle bit out. And I ended up with, I said it out loud one day, Versonic. And I thought, boom, that's it. So it's good. And a lot of people have, you know, I've had some complimentary remarks about it, like, oh, yeah, really cool name. And so that's why I decided to, this is not about me, this podcast, by the way. But
I like it. Carry on.
But I'm glad to hear you're feeling Versonic. But a lot of people have said, you know, that's a really cool name. You know, where did it come up? So I've got that, you know, explanation in there. And then obviously, then I thought I needed to do something with it. So that's where the limited company came in. It was, you know, I set the company up called Versonic Music Limited, which was basically an ambitious project of mine to realize any kind of royalties that came from my music, that came from my song. It came through the company rather than through me personally. So I'm still waiting, by the way, but...
Most of us are, mate.
Never say never, though. But but we don't do it for the money, though, do we, Jamie? We do it for the love.
That's it. Otherwise, you know, 20 years on, I wouldn't be doing it, I don't think, if I was worried about earning money from it.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah. So I was going to say, I mean, 20 years, I mean, you are a young man, you know, in the prime of life and everything, but you've been involved in music for, you know, more years than you probably care to remember. I mean, you started out, what, 14, 15 or something?
Yeah. It was on my 15th birthday that my brother Justin bought me a bass guitar. My mum's said to him, like, I was a bit of a tearaway for a little while. And my mum was like, I don't know what to do with him. You know, you need to take charge now. You're his older brother. Justin's 4 years older than me.
Yeah.
And he's like, I've got an idea. So Justin was already in bands and playing music. I'd already seen him live a couple of times, probably against the law, actually, to go into a pub at 14, but I was there. And I was like, this is pretty awesome. He's an amazing songwriter. I'd love to be part of this. And then one morning on my 15th birthday, he came in my room and goes, there you go, and just shoved a bass at me. I was like,
nice delivery.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, what's this about? He's like, look, you're going to learn that. You're going to come to rehearsal with me on Monday. We haven't got a bass player anymore, and I want you to play bass for us. And I hadn't played a note on a bass in my life.
So had you actually picked up a guitar before?
No. I mean, yeah, I picked one. I played around with it. I learned drums. I was doing drum lessons before that. And then, I never really picked up a guitar. And then this bass was in my hands. And it was at the point where I was kind of getting into like Nirvana as well. So, you know, their songwriting is so simplistic. It's very simple but effective. So I could learn those songs and I could start playing around on bass with those songs. And then I went to rehearsal and realized, oh, okay, Justin's just going to show me everything I need to play. So he'd point to the fretboard and say, it's that one, it's that one. I wouldn't even know the notes, you know. He'd say, it's that one, it's that one. You play that for, you know, I was lucky enough to have good rhythm and timing. He says, you play that for, you know, like four bars or whatever. And that's how I got into, yeah, into playing live music and then fell in love with
it. Yeah. I suppose if you're, you know, if you were to pick up a bass, you know, for the first time and everything, there's a difference, I think, in, you know, learning how to play it. But when it comes to, you know, you kind of know your way around the fretboard or whatever, or where you need to put your fingers and stuff to make a certain sound or, you know, play a note on it. It's very different, isn't it, when you have to time it with other musicians, you know? So when you go into a rehearsal room, it's very different from sitting in your bedroom, you know, slapping the bass or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you've got the timing to go with the drummer or you know, and the other players, obviously. So yeah. So did you adapt to that quite quickly then? Or?
I think I did, you know, because I played drums before. I mean, not to a high standard, but I had always had decent rhythm, I think. So yeah. It kind of helped when you're on the bass guitar. It's a natural thing to pick up that rhythm. And you know, the hardest thing when you're playing in any band is making sure the drummer's in time, not you. So the drummer was really good, so I was in time then. And I think, you know, at that point when I stood in that rehearsal room, bearing in mind that's the first time I've been in a room with other instruments playing at the same time. And it just blew me away. I think that was a moment where it was literally changed my whole life, because I've been in music longer than I have been not, if that makes sense, you know.
Yeah.
I was 15 then. You know, I'm 35 now. It's all I've known, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably, you know, well done for Justin for seeing
that
to kind of set you on your way there. So as far as he was concerned then, how long has he been playing guitar? How long had he been playing before he gave you that bass?
He's 4 years older than me. And he started playing guitar properly, probably when Oasis were at their peak. Or maybe just when they started, I suppose. In the sense of when they started to get popular. I always remember him being in his room strumming along, and he saw them at Earl's Court, I think, and you know, he got really into that in the UK Britpop, I shouldn't say India, Britpop scene, really. So he was, I suppose I would have been maybe 10 and he would have been 14, 15 it was always there. But my parents are musical. And my sister's like grade 8 pianist and flutist as well. Is flutist the right word? Yeah. Sounds like flirtist. She doesn't flirt. She plays the flute.
Flirtist. Yeah, yes, yeah. I think that's it. Yeah.
So music's always been around me.
Yeah. So your heritage is from Italy, isn't it? Your family, Italian family.
My dad's Sicilian, and my mum's from Stevenage.
What a combo.
Yeah, slightly different.
What a combination. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. But yeah.
So where did they meet then? How did they get together then?
I think they met through a friend. I think my dad came over here in the 60s. He was at the 66 World Cup final. His English teacher bought him tickets to all the games.
Amazing.
Yeah, so he was there as a young Sicilian lad. He was 18.
Brilliant.
Yeah, he was there. He came over in the 60s and they met whenever it was.
I suppose in terms, like you say, I mean, I think in, you know, music terms, you know, I think a lot of us are influenced by, you know, what our parents play or what you kind of hear, you know, as a kid growing up. So you say they were musical, and what kind of stuff were they listening to?
So my mum was really into Pink Floyd. Moody Blue. Justin's named after Justin Hayward from the Moody Blues.
Mm.
And my dad was more into, I suppose, the stereotypical stuff, you know, some opera, but also Sinatra, Dean Martin, a lot of that kind of swing stuff. And you know,
Rat Pack stuff. It does have that kind of, you know, Italian kind of Latin flair, doesn't it, with that kind of swing sound.
I always remember Sunday morning football, sitting in a car with Pavarotti blasting, thinking, oh, this is so embarrassing. But, you know.
trying to educate you, Jamie.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, so that's great. So you got the, you know, no looking back from there then, really. You got this bass guitar at 15. Yeah. You start jamming with, you know, with the band. And do you want to name check then? What was the band called?
Oh, my goodness. This is a name and a half. Right, okay.
Can you remember?
Yeah, no, I remember all the names. I've gone through quite a few band names with Justin. This band was named after, it was called Rapeseed, after the rapeseed oil. But I think it had other connotations as well. It wasn't a great name, okay? But that was our start.
Bit oily.
Bit oily. Yeah. That was our starting point. I think Justin's excuse is why it was called Rapeseed was because of the oil and flowers for my parents, but I think it probably had darker connotations to what it meant. Yeah. Anyway, teenagers and stuff, you know how it is. I played my first gig a month later.
Oh, fantastic. Yes, and as I said, you haven't stopped since then. You know, I kind of followed your career probably about, I don't know, 6 or 7 years became aware of Bright Light City, which was the one that you was the most serious band then out of that, would you say?
Probably not, in the sense of trajectory we were going on. One of our bands called Year Zero was actually quite a high point in our careers at a very young age, and it all kind of imploded.
Were the two of you in that?
Band? We were in that. I've been in bands with Justin the whole time. So that was after the Rapeseed band. We were called Year Zero, and it was part of the post-hardcore movement, probably early 2000s. We started gaining quite a large following. MySpace was a thing. We toured with Enter Shikari, quite a few bands who are big nowadays. We're playing to the difference is we're playing to 200-300 people at our own shows back then. And then you get a bit older and people start to lose interest in, you know, what you're doing. You play in front of two people. That was probably a pinnacle in our career that was totally mismanaged by us. But then Bright Light City came back around and we started using what we'd learned, that we'd learned, and we'd try to make a thing of it that way. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I was a big fan of Bright Light City. I love the music. I like your songwriting. I had the good fortune to play a show with you, didn't we? Was it the Back Room in Guildford, wasn't it? You headlined a gig for us, which was really nice. And one of the things that really has always struck me about you is your passion for it, your passion for music. But like you say, if you're playing, you play the same whether you're playing to two people or 2,000 people.
That's right. Justin's basically exactly the same as me, and I've learned that from Justin, really. I remember I played a gig once, and it was when we were kind of getting quite well known in our old band, Year Zero. I got a bit arrogant. I was a teenager, being a little dickhead, really, if I can swear, sorry. But I got on stage and I just wasn't feeling it. And there was like 150 people there turned out to watch us. And we had a manager at the time. And I was just like, I was basically just taking the piss and not putting any effort in.
Yeah.
And he came up to me at the end. He goes, "Oh, this is my mate Bob." And I was like, "All right." He goes, "Yeah, he wants his money back." I was like, "What do you mean?"
Yeah.
And I said, "Oh, what do you mean?" He goes, "Oh, he wants his money back. You know, you're absolutely shit up there. You're taking the mick. These people have paid to see you. He wants his money back." And then, Justin's like, "Yeah, he's right. You know, you need to start taking this seriously."
Wow.
And then I was like,
"Blimey, what a learning."
Yeah, and then it hit. Yeah. I was probably 16, 17. As this was when I was actually on vocals at that point. And I was like, "Okie dokie." And I remember Justin saying to me, "Look, it doesn't matter if there's two people or 200 people. Yeah. Those two people are still paid to see you."
Yeah.
And that's how we've always gone about it. Yeah.
Well, I think it's a pretty good life lesson there as well. You know, for people listening there. I mean, if you do anything less than your kind of best performance or the best, you know, attempt that you could possibly do, then you are shortchanging people, you know, as you say, particularly if people have, I'm not having a go at you, by the way.
That's fine. No,
at 16, yeah. at 16 that's I can, fine. We can probably forgive you, but the main point being is that you've learned from that experience.
Yeah.
And it was a one-off, and it's certainly, well, not from my experience, you know, happened since then. So, it sounds to me that, Justin has been a really kind of guiding light through, you know, for you as an older brother.
100%, yeah.
Throughout your, you know, teens and early 20s, should I say.
It's the voice of reason all the time with everything, you know. I can get quite kind of short-tempered with things, especially if we're songwriting previously and stuff, or I want things done now and then kind of thing, if you know what I mean. I like to get things done quickly, but Justin's a bit more hang on, think about it, let's just see what we can do here. The voice of reason, which is brilliant, and he has been and he continued to be my best friend. So it's like, you know,
a guiding that's fantastic. Yeah. Beautiful, isn't it? You know, guiding light and influence, you know, which what else could you want from an older brother?
That's it, yeah.
And you were the annoying little
young
one.
He doesn't let me forget that either.
No, I don't suppose he does. All right, so getting into that kind of world then, at 15. Mm. But I remember chatting to you because our paths crossed when you used to music studio, didn't you? And rehearsal room. It was called the music room. And I think that's where I first kind of came into contact with you, because the band I was playing with, I was kind of as a fledgling songwriter trying to, you know, play my own music, which was, you know, halfway for me to kind of achieving this dream to eventually play these songs live, you know, in a live music venue. I had this thing about, obviously, I wanted to be able to, you know, do all these things, but I wanted to play the guitar as well. So rehearsals, we rehearsed at your place.
That's right.
And I think it was there that you first told me that you, so you're a bit of an all-rounder then, I would say, because you've obviously you can play, you can sing, but you're also quite high on the technical side of things, aren't you, with on music production. Yeah. So how did that start? How did you get into that world? Because you've kind of, seems to me you've done them all simultaneously.
Yeah, it's a bit weird. That's how my brain works. I do quite a lot of things at once and hopefully one of them works. But I fell in love with the recording side of things and the studio side of things. I had work experience whilst I was at school at Rack Studios in St. John's Wood. One of the, I mean, at the time, again, I didn't realise the magnitude of that place and how much history was there. I remember making a cup of coffee for a guy called Nigel Godridge, who turns out to be one of the biggest record producers in the UK. He's like doing Radiohead Kid A at the time when I was there. And he was working on Divine Comedy's album as well. And then this guy came in who owned the studio called Mickey Most, never heard of him. This is the thing. When you're 15, you don't understand these things. You know, Robert Plant was sitting in reception, didn't know who that was. And I'm just like, and all of these things are happening all at once. And I was taken under the wing of a guy called Boris who worked there, and he worked on Muse's first album, Showbiz. And I was chatting to him and I was just watching him work, and it was all reel to reel. I think Pro Tools rigs had just come in at the time, because I know Nigel Godrich was using them on the Divine Comedy album and Kid A album. So I saw that being wheeled around. It was massive, not like it is now.
Wow.
And then Boris was in the studio and I was watching him work. I was like, this is incredible. He was turning all the EQs and working with all the outboard gear and compressors. And I was like, man, this is like, wow. You know?
Yes.
Yeah.
So how did you find it? How did that come about then? Did I miss that at the start of that? How did you get to go to Rack Studios?
Oh, well, it's who you know, isn't it? My mum, it was friends with at the time, someone who worked within the BBC sound department, I think it was. I think it kind of went from there, because I went to my careers advice thingy at school, and I remember sitting down. They said, oh, what do you want to be? This is when I was in the band already, and I'd already played lots of gigs in London at 15, etc.
Yeah.
I thought, I'm going to be a rock star. And they're like, oh, that's not like really a realistic career path. We can't get you work experience as being a rock star. And they write this report and they send it back. And my mum's read it, and she's obviously thought, what's he talking about? He's going to be a rock star. But then she actually, throwing back, took her and contacted her friend and said, look, Jamie wants to get into music. Do you know, have any contacts? And it's thanks to her that I, you know, saw that side of things, really.
Yeah, that's amazing, isn't it? As you say, I mean, that's not necessarily what you know, it's who you know, particularly in this industry, I suppose. But I suppose, you know, at that kind of age you were then, I suppose a lot of boys, they want to be rock stars or footballers, you know, whichever comes first. But were you into the sort of sports side of things, or was it all about music for you?
I was into it up until a point, but as soon as I discovered music, everything else just fell away. I was into acting as well, you know. I did drama, A-level drama and stuff, but I was always, music just took over. It just became everything. And it still is. I mean, I've got older now. You start to get a bit more cynical about stuff. But it's still everything. I still wake up. I still write songs that I've never seen the light of day, you know?
Yeah. So on that then, so how do you, what's your process for writing then? Are you one of these people that kind of, you know, shut yourself away? Or do you come up with like lyrical ideas or melody ideas first? What's your process?
It all depends on the moment, I suppose. I mean, when I was doing the newer project stuff with our new band, that was all written traveling to and from work, being bored on the train, just coming up with things, being inspired by the newspapers I could see on the seat, people were talking about, etc. But other times, Justin just would send over something on a voice note to me or whatever, and said, I've been working on this idea. Just working on melodies and then developing lyrics around melodies. I really pride myself on hopefully being able to write a hook or a decent top line. I kind of think I can. I don't know, maybe I can't. I mean, maybe it's just, I'm just foolish in thinking that, but I like writing top lines, hooks, melodies, but also trying to get some sort of integrity and meaning in there as well.
Yeah, yeah. And I would say that about your song, certainly towards the, I suppose, better point out that Bright Light City, you kind of moved on from that, but... a lot of the Bright Light City stuff that I listen to, they are meaningful songs, you know, with that kind of message in there as well. Yeah. And when you have that combination, when it's delivered with such passion, you know, through, you know, you as a live performer, it kind of really hits home. And it's, you know, and I would say that, you know, watching Bright Light City, the energy in the band was just amazing, you know, especially is it Ben on drums and, yeah, so, you know, really, really, you know, great delivery from what I saw you live then. Right. So, yeah, so from there then, you have been in this life and you kind of done all those things in terms of this, you know, the production side or the kind of rounded knowledge of music and how the industry mm-hmm. works, which I suppose was the next progression that led you to, we now run a label, of course, right, yeah. Which we're going to have a chat around. Do you just want to tell us a little bit more about that and how that kind of came definitely. Around and what it does and how you operate?
Yeah, of course. So the background story really is born of frustration, I think, with the actual industry itself. And I think it's because we're of a generation when we all play music. So back when I was 15, 16 or whatever, for that 5-year period, 2000 to 2005 or maybe upwards of that, there seemed to be more opportunity and more buzz around getting a record deal, you know, getting noticed that way, getting your physical album or a single into a shop, that excitement of going into a record shop and seeing it. And that seemed to fade away and die a little bit. And we went through a career, you know, our career, I like to call it, in Bright Light City, towards the end, like 2017, when we had this EP ready. And we all sat down and heard listened to that EP. It was called Our Future's Not Dead. And it was when Tom joined the band on bass. And as soon as he joined, everything just clicked. And I was just like, I said to the guys at rehearsal, I remember sitting on a stool at my old studio. So this needs to go. So we need to do something with this. Like, we need to get it out there to a wider audience, or even have more things available that people can buy, because I think we've done something that's really special here. And that's just, that was our opinion, and people might not think it was. But for us, it was like, we've found a sound finally. After being in Bright Light City for 7 years up until that point, where everything was working. So I just sat there and said, look, I've got an idea. Like, shoot me down if you don't think it's a great idea. But I fancy starting up a record label, and I fancy starting up the same ethos as DIY labels were in the beginning, like Sub Pop, Discord Records, Epitaph, which are huge now, but, you know. And I said, you know, are you up for it? Do you want to do it? And it was all agreed on, it'll be worth it. But then you have to look at the process of how you do that. How do I physically get, I understand digital distribution, like the back of my hand, but I want that physical distribution too. And I want a wider reach. And also what I really want is to be able to get other opportunities from that music, like, you know, publishing, sync deals, etc. And the only way you're going to get that and be successful with it, I think, is going with a company that seems bigger than is actually, you know, you. So going from a major distribution company. So anyway, I got a list of distribution companies together with Justin. And we just said to each other, let's just go for it. Let's just email this distribution company. Some of them, you know, it was like Columbia, it was Universal, it was Sony. And they all have these like little distribution, big distribution companies attached to them for digital and physical. Yeah. We've got a little kind of email together, not really a business plan as such. It was a bit tongue-in-cheek as well. It was a bit cheap. It was a bit funny. Sent it out to all these companies and then heard nothing. I was like, oh, great. Okay, this is... we're just going to have to stick it on your usual streaming sites and stuff, which is fine. But I wanted more. We wanted more. And we got an email back about a week and a half later from what was then Red Essential, which was owned by Sony. And they were a big distributor at the time. And I was like, wow, Red Essential, cool. There's loads of bands I listen to on Red Essential. And the guy was like, oh, you know, I love what you're doing. Can you give me a ring? And I was like, oh, man. I don't like talking to people at the best of times on the phone. I'm a bit funny like that. And especially about something that could be potentially as big as this for us. Anyway, I had my pep talk from Justin, you know. And he said, you know, just go for it. Just be yourself and just talk about how much, you know, you love music and this means to us and what we want to do. Mm-hmm. And he went for it. He sent us a contract and we signed a distribution deal with Sony Red Essential then, which is now moved over to The Orchard. And if anyone out there doesn't know who The Orchard are, they're like one of the biggest music distribution companies in the world now. They're owned by Sony as well. And it all happened on a punt, really. And then we put out that EP on vinyl and CD, went in the shops. It was received really well. It charted in iTunes. I think it was like top five, whatever. But, you know, 4K rang. And it was great. And then that was the impetus we needed to go, right, let's go and get some more bands. Let's build a family kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, on the the formats that you just described there, I've got it on vinyl.
Oh, there you go. I've still got about 100 left, by the way.
Out of exactly.
That's it.
Well, I've got one of them. But they do become collector's items, you know. Don't they? Kind of, there was a bit of a resurgence on vinyl. Well, I don't know what it's like nowadays, but I suppose it's because of the way the industry's changed and the immediacy of how people want to consume, you know, their music nowadays. Yeah. You know, it's, you know, like if I take my daughters, for example, if it's not on their phone, it doesn't exist, you know. So, but one of the things I will say on there, and I just really doff my cap, and, you know, one of the things about the Feeling Bisonic podcast is to, you know, talk to people like, you know, like yourself that have this kind of, that's a really entrepreneurial approach, the kind of DIY approach where you want something, it's not going to happen organically. So you do it yourself, and whether you knew your way around or not, the fact is, you know, you went for it. And that's one of the things that I've been really advocating on the podcast. You know, if you have a dream or you have an idea, then don't wait till you've got all your ducks in a row and for something else to happen. Just do it and look what happened for you. You know, you took that risk. But one thing, you know, when you sent out all those messages, I'm interested though, were you expecting a reply? Because sometimes it's almost like, I know it's a kind of throwing a load of mud at the wall and some of it will stick, but did you expect to get responses from, you know, if you sent music out to somebody asking for, you know, some sort of reaction or whatever, do you expect them to come back?
I suppose for the amount of time, the thing that makes me made us cynical as musicians, and I think cynical is probably the wrong word, but it's the only one I can think of right now, is the fact that you get so used to rejection. You get hardened.
And you have
get
to.
Hardened by rejection. You know, that was 17 years into my career in music. Man, rejection happens every single time you try and do something that betters your current situation in music. And some people are complete arseholes with their rejection. No, I wasn't. We weren't expecting to get anything back, but then we didn't really know what we're doing anyway. So it was like, if they said yes, then we'll just take the next step and say, okay, now what do we do?
Yeah.
Like, you know, with publishing coming up with us with the label now as well, it's like, I don't really know what I'm doing, but we've got the publishing deal now, so I'm just going to go with it and see what happens.
Yeah, no, absolutely, yeah. And I saw just recently you got one away on a computer game, wasn't it? Was that a Bright Lights?
Yeah, it was. But that agreement
from
the album. That was only reason we got that is because we set up the label. So you see how it all works, you know? That was pitched by the sync company and publishing company attached to The Orchard. And we signed that agreement about a year ago or a year and a half ago maybe, and we didn't hear anything. And then out of nowhere, Justin messaged me at like 1 a.m. saying, have you seen the streams? Have you seen the messages on Facebook or whatever? And I'm like, no. And it turns out the game was released and we're on it. So it's like, okay, fair enough.
Brilliant. Yeah. Congratulations. Well, that could be quite an opportune moment then for me to, I'm going to play that
track.
And it's called Feast on Fear by Bright Light City.
Feeling lost, feeling alone.
So that was Feast on Fear by Bright Light City, appearing in the computer game Watch Dogs Legion now, from Undead Collective and their distribution. And congratulations on that, Jamie. That's absolutely brilliant. But I just wanted to move on to maybe some of the other bands that you have on your roster then. And because we're going to play some tracks from there that we can maybe showcase. And one band that is known to me as well, with kind of mutual friends in that band, is JSA.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, great band.
Yeah. So they are a great band. And I know that, again, they have this whole, the love of music and the, you know, the professionalism and the attitude and everything that they have. And again, their delivery of the track they just released, actually, Fool's Empire. So we're gonna play that a bit later on as well. So what is it that you're looking for as a label for the bands that you sign?
First and foremost, they have to be down-to-earth, decent people. You know, no egos, none of that. Just people who are hardworking, who have passion for music, who we know can play live. You know, most of the bands we sign, well, apart from JSA, but we know how good they are as musicians anyway. So going against our ethos slightly, but every other band we've signed, we had to have seen them live to carry that off. And just a band that can be supportive and work as a collective, because we have no funding, we have no money. We can't invest anything in the label until we get things back. So for example, that sync for the Watch Dogs Legion game, the money we're going to get from that, the fee we're going to get from that, half of that's going to go back into the label. Then we can start investing. So it's having bands that understand it's not going to be a quick thing, but we're going to support them as much as we can and in every way we can, and work tirelessly to do that.
I've seen that firsthand, of course, you know, because you, well, when we could, of course, you've done label, you know, gigs with bands from the roster coming and playing live at the Fighting Cox, wasn't it? Was that you've done a couple there. And one thing I liked about that as well is that I remember you saying was, you know, everybody gets paid. So if you charge the general public, you know, a fiver to see what four live bands, you know, fantastic. And they've always been packed out, haven't they? You always get a good response to them. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. At least the bands get something out of it as well. So it's not just, even if it's just a kind of beer and a curry, whatever, but, you know, or their travel costs or whatever it might be, at least the bands are being paid for performing.
Really hope that you are enjoying the podcast so far and that you are feeling the Sonic, just like Jamie and I. Please do subscribe on Apple Podcast and or follow on Spotify. If you would be so kind as to leave a review, that would be very much appreciated. On with the show.
But you touched on the festival there. I can't let you get away without enlarging on that then. Was that a Bright Light City thing? And what was the thing about Canada?
So we were picked from, I don't know, I think it was like a couple of thousand bands. I don't know what it was. I don't quite remember the whole process. But it was the opportunity to go over to Canada, and they run a festival called Envol en Macadam, which is like a massive punk festival over a weekend. And you basically go to, we went to, I think it was Syria, not Syria, but Syria in King's Cross, which is a venue. We played there, and there was a lady who wanted to see us to see if it was suitable for the festival, which is fine, kind of useful, that kind of stuff. Anyway, we got the gig. It turns out it's like an all expenses paid. They fly you out there, you know, hotel. We played a set on the main stage at the festival, and then we played a couple of little gigs in and around Quebec. And it was just, we, to this day, we sit there and like, we just talk about it. It's one of the best experiences I've ever had in music. And you know, we haven't made loads of money. We're not famous. I don't want to be famous, but what we have done is created these amazing memories, these little blocks of memories that I can go back to.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's full on rock star stuff, isn't it?
For a weekend.
You know, well, that's all right. I'd take it.
That's great. Yeah.
But that's great. All right, so I think it's about time we had a little bit more music then. So the next track that we're going to play are signed to Undead Collective. Are you Undead Collective or Undead Collective Records? What's the full title?
Undead Collective Records.
Undead Collective Records. Okay, so through Undead Collective Records, this is JSA and their most recent single, released last week, I think, or the week before maybe. But it's out there, videos on YouTube. and on all the mainstream digital music streaming and download platforms. This is JSA and Fool's Empire. So that was Fool's Empire by JSA. Absolute banger, Jamie, I think. Is that the right description?
Yeah, that's the one. Very good.
Really, really good. Yeah, so energetic. And, you know, young David Marley there. I think he's got a great voice, hasn't he? And he's really, really good. And the guitars and the lads that we know in the band, you know, they're so, so good. And, yeah, great sound from JSA there. So other bands that you've got then that you've you know that you've got on the roster, and I know some of them are kind of they've been signed as a you know longer term mm-hmm. thing, but maybe they're not together mm-hmm. anymore, or
yeah.
some of them have gone off on done their own sort of solo things and stuff. But obviously the music is still registered to the label. Yeah. So yeah, so who else have you got there that to have it for people to make people aware of?
So we started signing bands on like an EP by EP basis to start with. So we had a band called Loose Tooth, Seasonal, we've got Merrick's Tusk, Springfall Sea, Best of Enemies. So yeah, it was just like we kind of built up a roster of bands, and then we started signing bands on a more of a longer term deal more recently.
Yeah. Well, the familiar one there was Best of Enemies. I kind of know, but I have, you know, had the privilege of seeing them live, and great frontman they've got as well, haven't they? And young Sam Christmas. Brilliant.
Sam is an absolute genius. Definitely,
he's He's got real talent. Well, first time I saw him, well, Best of Enemies, they were playing at that place in Croydon. It's like a cafe.
Scream Lounge? No,
it wasn't Scream Lounge. No, it was Matthew's Yard.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It's like a coffee shop and everything all into one, isn't it? With the back room. So I saw them there a few Januaries ago. And what struck me was that they've almost kind of got this, when you see them live, they've almost kind of got this kind of orchestrated lineup where they're all in step.
Yeah, yeah.
not like a boy band, but you know what I mean? With like a wall of guitars, you know, with Sam in the middle. And I think they're just great to watch, brilliant. You know, and a great sound as well, of course. Yeah.
Fantastic bands. You're going to ask me how long I've known Sam, haven't you?
certainly longer than I have, but how did that kind of come about?
In the recording studio, he emailed me asking for work experience. The irony of it was that I was 26 and he was 16, and he emailed me and said, "You got any work experience?" And obviously, we weren't making real money in the studio anyway. And I said, "Oh, unfortunately, not, because I want to pay people if they're going to work there. I don't want them to work for free."
Yeah,
and I actually thought, I'll give it a go. And then Sam turned up and he used to open up and lock up studio for rehearsal. We used to pay him, I don't know what it was, probably below minimum wage. He was grateful because he was a young lad, wasn't working or anything. And then we just kind of stayed friends from there, really.
And was he playing at that point?
He was in another band, and I can't quite remember what their name was. It was a lot heavier than Best of Enemies. And then I sold the studio and Sam was playing a Best of Enemies, probably a bit before that, really, actually. And I've stayed in touch with him ever since because he's a talented bugger. So he is.
Yeah. Well, I remember actually one of those gigs that we had the label gigs that you had at the Fighting Cocks.
Yeah.
He was, I remember being very impressed actually with his, I think the word is dexterity.
Yeah, yeah.
Where he knocked the mic stand over and he managed to carry on playing and catch the mic. before it actually hit the floor, and then just like carry on as if nothing had happened. I thought, how the hell
always
did
alert,
he do that?
always sober.
So,
I think
so. good reaction. Yeah, so that was probably before he had a beer. Then, exactly. Cool. All right, so probably good time then for us to play. How would you describe their music, incidentally? What genre would you put it in, and you know, how would you describe their sound?
Oh God. That's a really hard question,
isn't it? Yeah, well, because I was trying to sum it up, thinking, you know, but they've got something, but I'm not quite sure what the description is.
Let's leave it at that then. They're a unique sound, really, aren't they?
They've got this great sound. We're going to play a track, one of my favorite tracks that I've got kind of, you know, on my music list and on my playlist and everything like that. So never tire of listening to this. This is a track called "Call to Arms" by Best of Enemies.
Call to us, and nothing will bring me down. keeps turning. This is my call to arms, and nothing will bring me down. Right now I know the world keeps turning. This is my call to arms, and nothing will bring me down. Right now I know the world keeps turning.
So that was Call to Arms by the brilliant Best of Enemies. So, yeah, I'm a big fan of that band, Jamie. But we've probably come to the end of the time that we've got available on the podcast. We've had some great music and some, you know, really interesting chat. But I'm going to take you back to that stroppy teenager and your and your telling off from your big brother about not trying. And, you know, so obviously you progressed, you know, a million miles from there, you know, to where you are, you know, today, as a label owner and anything. So what advice would you give to your 16-year-old self and that stroppy kid, you know, attitude? What advice would you give to somebody that's kind of looking to put a band together now at, say, you know, 16, 17 or whatever age they are to kind of go the distance?
I suppose the first thing I'd say is just appreciate every opportunity you're given, because like in this current situation, who knows when we're going to gig again. I haven't gigged in, you know, it's like everyone else, in 8-9 months. That's the most time I've ever had out of gigging. Before that, the most time I ever had out of gigging was, I think, 2-3 weeks, genuinely, in 20 years. And I miss it. So appreciate every single opportunity you're given. Make sure that whoever turns up to your show, you put on the best performance you can ever put on in your life. And don't worry if it's 1, 2, 200, whatever. You put in the maximum amount of effort into that performance, because you never know who's going to be there.
And what about commitment then and things like that? Because I think I see a lot of kind of here today, gone tomorrow type things where you think, oh, what happened to them? You know, they're really good. Or I suppose, you know, bands split for a whole host of reasons, don't they? But, you know, I think if you can, you know, I mean, do bands, do you think, have a lifespan?
I think if you're fortunate enough to have that balance where you can actually earn money from being in a band, which is pretty much impossible really nowadays. I mean, I don't want to put people off, but, you know, it's hard, a lot harder for a start.
Well, it's mainly through performance, exactly, isn't it? It's the only way that the band's through doing gigs.
Yeah, and I think the lifespan of a band is kind of, it relates to how they can keep themselves afloat in their real life balance as well.
It's all about the music as well, of course, isn't it? You know, because you've got to have good music, you've got good songs.
Definitely,
So that's part of it as well, I suppose. But you said about what is it, do you think, that kind of made you do the kind of long haul in music then? Is it something that you kind of, you know, you felt, or because it's an emotive thing, isn't it? And as a songwriter, it's quite a cathartic thing in terms of, you know, writing and getting your thoughts out there and kind of bringing it out in music. So was it for you a kind of an emotive decision that kind of hooked you in? How you felt?
It was therapeutic, emotive. It helped me through situations. You know, writing, especially the album for Bright Light City, was a massive kind of weight off my shoulders. For talking about mental health issues, anxiety, depression. You know, and music's always been that for me. It's either been at a stage or a point of being rebellious and saying what I want and having that angsty side when I was a teenager, to being more reflective and using it as a tool for therapy. And live, I think Justin's the same as me. I think most of the lads in the band are the same as me. When I get on that stage and I do a 45-minute set or whatever it is, I don't remember most of it when I come off, because I go somewhere else. It's a really weird thing.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was kind of alluding to is, you know, when I've kind of spoken to you before a gig, and I've been to see Bright Light City, you're a completely different person when you're on. You kind of get in this zone, and you also like climbing on things, Jamie, don't you?
Yeah. I get told off for that by my wife.
Jamie, get down off there. And I totally get that. You know, with the, you know, the, as you say, the. I think a lot of us, you know, particularly creative people, you know, they do have these issues, and this is a way of you know, overcoming them. And you know, if you're nervous about something, of course, that could give you the adrenaline to kind of get through a show. Whether you actually do you enjoy yourself.
When I'm on stage, Yeah. When the first songs kind of starts, I'm there. Before I go on, I'll say this quite openly. I've said this to the band members as well, is that I hate the idea of being a frontman. I hate the processes you have to go to be a frontman, because the pressures are different on someone who's a frontman, especially if you don't play an instrument as well. You have four people around you, or however many people on stage with you, who can just turn their back or hide a little bit. But you've got to be there, and you've got to put on that show, you know. And I started to feel that pressure a lot more the later in kind of Bright City career.
So is that self inflicted? 100%. Self inflicted pressure. Do you put your 100%. Exactly? You put yourself under pressure because you want that kind of perfect delivery, don't you? And so you get anxious about performing because you want it to be 100%, you know, absolutely bang on, and you know, an energy and everything else. Well, I have to say, I mean, every time I've seen you, mate, you've been right in there, and you know, it's been a great delivery. I've often commented on it. So, but I suppose the last 10 minutes, one thing that I haven't touched on is the podcast that you've started up. And I can't have my own podcast without asking you about your podcast. So this, of course, is the Feeling Masonic podcast. And so you've started, how long has it been going? So it's a podcast called On Repeat.
And it's got like, don't get confused with the other On Repeat podcast. Alwyn has like a little kind of green cat logo. That would help you out. Oh, that will help you out.
Okay, On Repeat. So yeah, just want to tell our lovely listeners about that, because you mentioned Nirvana right at the very beginning of the interview, and obviously been a major influence on you, but in similar sort of taste with the guys in the band as well, then, because it's you're all kind of into the grunge stuff.
Yeah, I think that's probably the only genre really where we all kind of agree on as an influence. I mean, we've gone through, I mean, On Repeat itself was an idea sitting in a pub where we talk about music. That's all we do as a band, really. We would talk about our own music, the label, or other music, and then we thought about thinking about music we listened to in the past, things you had on repeat when you were younger. Justin's like, it's Justin's idea, so it's just called On Repeat. And then we started looking at genres we were into, and we've got now, I think we've got some in the backlog we haven't released yet. I just got to get around to mixing them. But we look at different genres that were around when we were younger, tours, like we've got stuff on like new metal, which I didn't really like at all, but Jono and Ben love. So it's quite a funny little dynamic in the room talking about music and influences, but then it does touch upon more serious things and how it's helped us as well find our identities, you know.
And I think it's a nice format, and so for anybody listening who wants to check that out, it's called On Repeat, the one with the green logo. So you can find it on all the, I'd imagine, you know, the main podcast streaming download platforms, Spotify podcast, Apple podcasts, etc. So So you basically you do it all together. Is everybody always there on every episode, and you just kind of mic up and chat in the room?
We kind of recorded a whole bulk before the first lockdown happened, when it was all mic'd up, and then recently we did like more of a socially distanced one in a bigger room, kind of mic'd up. But Jono hasn't been to a couple because he's ill, but rest of the time we're all in there having a chat, and it's like, the problem is it runs over because we all like to just talk about stuff that's ridiculous, so
it always does, doesn't it? So we've probably got about another 5 minutes, so I would say that's probably quite a nice place to kind of tail things off then in terms of the interview. And I would say, you know, have to say thanks, Jamie, for, you know, for sparing your time. I know that you're busy, you know, with everything and with, you know, young family and, you know, the whole thing that we've all got to go on with and stuff. So, I mean, we're actually recording this interview on the Friday, the day after another national lockdown. How are you kind of, you know, going to get through it?
I think this time around it's being positive. It's working out ways in which we can get out and about safely, so going for walks in the morning, getting some fresh air. I've got two children as well, so we don't want to be cooped up in a house together. It's my daughter's birthday on the Sunday, so it's going to be an occasion where we're going to make the most of it for her, because it's different.
Absolutely, get outside, I would say, you know. But there's actually I don't think they put any restriction on timings like they did in the first one, have they? But
I'm not too sure. I haven't really looked into it, to be honest with you. I'm just,
it keeps changing from day to day, doesn't it? So but you know, we're all kind of we've got to do it basically, and keep following these guidelines and everything, and let's hope we're through it sooner rather than later, I would say. All right, Jamie. So that's really good. Thanks again for joining me, and a big thanks to JSA and Bright Light City and Best of Enemies for sharing their music with us and allowing us to play them on the show. Thank you to Undead Collective Records, and thanks to you, mate, and thanks for joining me. And good luck with everything, and stay safe.
Will do. Thanks for having me. Really enjoyed it. Brilliant.
My pleasure. And good to chat to you. So hopefully I'll catch you at some point soon. Nice one. Cheers, Jamie.
My thanks again to Jamie for joining me on the podcast. Really enjoyed our chat. My name is Stephen Connor, and you have been listening to the Feeling the Sonic podcast. Until next time, keep calm, stay safe, and God bless.